Hello and welcome to Writing Relations Radio, an experimental podcast to uplift and support adult education and the movements for positive change across Turtle Island. Today we are talking to Hassan from the Migrant Workers Alliance for Change about the Honduran Migrant Caravan, Canadian immigration and displacement as asylum seekers arrived to the U.S. border in December 2018.
My name is Hassan, and I work for something called the Migrant Workers Alliance for Change. We're a national migrant worker rights body. And as of this weekend, we've also formed a new national immigrant and refugee groups organization called the Migrant Rights Network that will actually be launching on Tuesday. That will be hoping to coordinate combating racism and to fight for migrant justice. So I will speak briefly about the Honduras and the caravan, and specifically the ways in which Canada is complicit, and then kind of paint some broad ways in which the issue of the caravan and migration in general is being manifested here in Canada, and what I believe are some mechanisms both to support migrants and refugees in the caravan as well as people in here in the country. I'm going to try and keep my remarks fairly brief so that we have lots of time for conversation and discussion afterwards, because it's such a small, intimate gathering. So if we want to understand kind of what is happening in the Triangle region of Guatemala, El Salvador, and Honduras, we have to go back to the civil conflicts that arose in the late 60s, first in Guatemala, and then in the general region. Which, you know, really has to be centered around the creation of this company called INCO, a Canadian mining company that was very much involved in the in 1934, there was a U.S.-backed military coup, right, which brought up governments in Guatemala. And then this Canadian mining company, nickel mining company, INCO, began negotiations with successful military governments, creating many open pit mining in Guatemala. This creating kind of this like huge destabilization. This mining company received a lot of Canadian government support, and of course the rise of a revolutionary rebel forces, thus creating kind of a destabilization in the region, as in Canada creating the destabilization in the region. So really, if we look at the last of like 40, 50 years, it's not been just the United States that's been intervening in Latin America, but specifically Canada through its mining interest with enormous amounts of support by the Canadian government. If we fast forward in 2009, there was a democratically elected government of President Zelaya, who was deposed in a military-backed coup that was greatly supported by the Canadian government. Part of the reason that the Canadian government did that is because, as people like Tyler Shipley and Todd Gordon have documented, the Zelaya government had placed a moratorium on granting new mining rights to Canadian corporations. And primarily, I mean, I'm sure we all know, but 75% of the world's mining companies are headquartered in Canada. So Canada is really the global hub of this. And the reason they're headquartered here is because of the very lax mining laws and oversights and regulations. So they may not necessarily be Canadian owned or Canadian, but they're paying taxes here and have set up an office here and are trading the Toronto or the Vancouver stock exchanges. So the Zelaya government was trying to write a new mining code that would better protect labor and environment. That was immediately followed by this massive coup. And the Canadian government not only supported in words but also in deeds. The government that came out, the military-backed government, which of course immediately wrote a new mining law, which gave great concessions to Canadian mining companies. And to not just that, but in 2011, Canada's then Prime Minister Stephen Harper went to Honduras to sign the Canada-Honduras Free Trade Agreement, where he, again supported in words and indeed what had been really an extremely slanted so-called election, which had been largely undemocratic and gravely corrupt and controlled by the military government. And it's interesting, so it's not just mining companies. I mean, part of during Stephen Harper's visit a women's organization that was working in sweatshops for Gildan Activewear, which is, you know, a Canadian company which creates a number of clothing items, actually did a huge campaign about the work of Gildan in the sweatshops he was running in Honduras. And Stephen Harper, instead of like bending to that pressure, in fact, visited a Gildan facility and showed how much they were in support of it. So really, there's been, you know, I could go on and on. There's Escobal, there's the silver mining in the hills. There is a Canadian company that is known to have actually tried to mine in secret burial sites to try and get access to the gold. You know, nothing is sacred in any way for these companies. And they've been supported by the federal government through, grants, through tax cuts, through very lax regulatory agreements, and largely allowed these human rights abuses to continue for their greater profit. So all of this brings us to the current conditions of Honduras and, of course, the broader region, which, you know, people are seeing enormous amount of poverty, environmental catastrophe, and some people are being persecuted by paramilitary gangs or criminal gangs that have started in part as a result of the Canadian and American intervention in the region. So at this point, you know, thousands of people, it's hard to say exactly how many people, have marched upwards of 4,000 kilometers from Honduras. People along the way in El Salvador and Guatemala, even in Mexico, have joined them, who are now at the border between US and Mexico in Tijuana. At least 6,000, over 6,000 people have arrived. And today is actually an extremely sad day because a child, a seven-year-old child who crossed into the U.S. just this week, a girl, she died in U.S. custody. So what happened was she was one of the people who just walked across, and she'd been detained for 8 hours, and she died from dehydration and shock. And she'd just arrived last week along with her father. And so this is the condition, you know, we've not received the name of the woman yet, but these are the conditions that people are facing. As we know, the U.S. government has been jailing families and children, similar to Canada, but at a much larger scale. So there are, so the border is, been turned into a militarized zone, and primarily it's been used by the right-wing government in the United States, the proto-fascist authoritarian government of President Trump, to create further and greater xenophobia and racism, criminalizing the idea of migrants and refugees, and creating this huge amount of uproar as a way essentially mobilizing it towards the November midterm elections. In fact, U.S. government mobilized thousands of soldiers and put them onto the border in this massive show of force when the migrants were actually still quite far away. And what has happened as a result is, you know, this has created a ripple effect of racism that has allowed, in part, for the right to win perhaps greater seats than it could have in the U.S. Now, thousands of people are at the border. There was, of course, an attempt, a protest on November 25th to try and actually enter the United States to apply for refugee status. Under international law, convention, and agreements, refugees are allowed to cross borders to seek protection and safety, but currently they're not being allowed in to actually apply for refugee status. So it's not even illegal to do so. It's illegal to cross, but it's not illegal to cross and then apply for refugee status. It's a little complicated, but that's kind of the structure. It's also similar to the structure we see on the US-Canada border, where people are crossing, you know, on foot from anywhere, but once they've crossed, they're allowed to apply for refugee status. So this is, you know, what we're kind of facing right now is thousands of people living in camps with very little food or water. But also, you know, it's not just a question of victims. It's a question of intense amount of courage and resilience. Thousands of people have walked over 4,000 kilometers. And in part, they walk together because it's a mode of transportation that's safer. But in the process of walking, I mean, people talk about this as a, you know, a democracy in action. It's a question, you know, the there are self-organized representatives that are responsible for media, for decision making, for public works, for there's just a women's led hunger strike that was also coordinated. So it's not as if it's kind of this like, you know, river or mob of just people randomly walking in one direction. In fact, their decisions along the way, their debates about which roads to take, etc., that have been made along the way by people. They're creating an entire society and a structure. And along the way, there has been an intense amount of support for them throughout the region. And of course, there have been some, xenophobic and racist protests also. So that's kind of the current condition. I mean, in terms of what is happening in Canada, there are, you know, a series of different kinds of people who are doing different kinds of actions and demands. So just to give you a brief snapshot, environmental mining justice activists have really been highlighting the role of Canadian mining in creating the conditions of violence and poverty that have disenfranchised people and forced them to move, asking for kind of stronger regulations and stronger protections and stronger, in fact, prosecution of companies who are responsible for human rights abuses. Of course, you know, we must talk about Berta Cáceres, the indigenous leader who was shot and killed by gunmen in La Esperanza on March 2nd. She was killed because she was denouncing aggression and she was organizing against a hydroelectric project in her community which is the territory of the Lenca indigenous people. So her death has, of course, sparked a global call to action, particularly that the Honduran government is deploying, extremely dangerous weapons and structures to shut down resistance. On the other hand, we've seen a lot of support organizations. There've been, vigils and protests, art making, visits from Canadians, both journalists, media makers, community activists, as well as Honduran activists, to go to Tijuana with materials, indigenous folks from Canada, indigenous groups and artists from Canada supporting the Honduran and Guatemalan and Salvadorian migrants who've arrived on the U.S. border. There have also been called for resettlement of the refugees and migrants from that are in this caravan into Canada. Of course, we don't know if that's what they want. It's hard to know for sure, but it's definitely been a call. And connected to it, people have talked about how if these people were actually able to walk across through the U.S. and try to enter Canada, they would be turned back because of the Safe Third Country Agreement, which says that if you've passed through a quote-unquote safe country first, you shouldn't be able to apply for status in Canada. And forcing people to take, kind of more risky routes to enter the country. And so therefore, the Safe Third Country Agreement should also be overturned. So there's a broad wave of calls and demands that are coming from different sectors for changes here. And I think I would invite people to kind of, if people want to take action in direct support of the caravan, define what's nearest to them, whether it's immigrant groups, immigrant and refugee rights groups, Honduran solidarity activists, artists, media makers, immigration activists, etc., to connect with and to move the struggle forward. The other thing is we have to really understand this mass migration in the context of what's happening globally. So we know that there are, over 65 million people who are refugees around the world, over 235 million migrants. There's millions of displaced people. We are seeing a global flow of people, whether we talk about the boats crossing in the Mediterranean, whether we talk about Syrians on foot, Afghanis on foot, people from Ethiopia and Eritrea and Congo. People are moving in masses or alone, separately or together, in search of refuge. And rarely, even if they're often moving in the same direction, have they been making joint decisions as they are now. So this is a specifically critical movement of what's happening with the migrant exodus for dignity, but it is part of this global flow. And the global flow is going to increase because we have environmental catastrophe, greater wars, an intensification of inequality of wealth between the richest and the rest. And And there's no real effort and combined effort to overturn it. In fact, this last weekend, as you may have heard, something called the Global Compact for Migration was signed in Marrakesh, which in Canada has been framed as either a document that would get rid of Canadian sovereignty over its borders, that's what the Conservatives have been pushing, and has been framed by the Liberals as if it is this, you know, hugely progressive step forward where Canada is kind of leading the way and will be teaching the world about how great its immigrant and refugee resettlement practices are. The Global Compact on Migration is, in fact, is a toothless document that doesn't actually deal with, A, because it doesn't actually create any agreement that will force governments to do better, and it doesn't deal with the two fundamental questions that we need to ask on any question of migration. One, what are the specific structures and ways in which we are stopping the forces of displacement? That is, how are we ensuring that people are moving freely rather than being pushed back, pushed out? And then second, how are we ensuring the rights and dignity of people once they have arrived in so-called receiving countries? And that's really not been done. If people are interested, we can talk more about the specifics of how Canada is doing on these questions outside of the Honduran caravan crisis. But very briefly, as we know, Canada has seen a long-term shift away from permanence into temporariness, generally speaking. Very few people can come here as permanent residents. Most people come here as temporary foreign workers, international students, refugee claimants, or other streams of people without full status. And the lack of full status is coupled with working in industries that are outside of regulations and protections. For example, agriculture, which is exempt from minimum wage, unionization, forced to live in employer-provided housing that's outside of housing regulations, often forced to live in fear of detention and deportation. And Canada is one of the countries in the world. I can suddenly hear myself.
I don't hear your echo, but it might be just the connection. Is it still doing it?
No, it's good. It's fine. So, yeah, so Canada is one of the few countries in the world with an indefinite detention process. And what we've seen, particularly in the refugee and asylum process, is that there's a huge backlog. Thousands of people have crossed over from the United States into Canada over the land border over the last 2 years since Trump's election are waiting in limbo. So there's lots more to say and discuss about what to do in Canada. And I have some proposals of what you all could do, but outside of this direct support for Honduras. But I want to kind of stop there initially, see if people have either questions or comments, something they want to add or disagree with, or have confusion around, so we can sort of delve together deeper. Yeah, Rihanna, maybe you can help facilitate this.
Yeah, well, I think your questions are good starters. Any comments or questions, confusions, disagreements?
Well, Rihanna, this is Najia, and I have a couple of questions. First is that most of these refugees, as Hossein said, is a sort of forced immigration and forced refugee. So it is not voluntarily somebody. That is not like traveling as a tourist going to another country for leisure or exposures. But nowadays, what we are observing globally is more of crisis. So it's, the roots of could be economic crisis, mining, militarizations, and many other things. But what I have the question is that this advanced development, having a very luxury life versus like all human, there is a sort of human market, others and others. So all of them and their day-to-day needs versus versus all other things that I mentioned. So how we can say, like, they have a counter argument is that we want advancement for human, and this is why we need to pull out all these mines to give better life for humanity, and then people are resistant to leave their space. So we need the space, we need the land, we do all this unrest to different areas to give a better life for the rest of the world. So this is most of the time the argument. So I it is a bit of confusing, but it also needs to be discussed.
So if I understand your question correctly, you're saying people believe that mining projects and their like are about development, and they are about improving people and not about displacement, right? That's your comment?
Yeah, I know that the cause of these like big company is to find resources for their justification is that we want to give better life for the rest of the world. And these people who are immigrating and suffering, so I'm a refugee for my all life since age of 16, so I'm out of my country, first in one country and then another country, and my children all experience in the same. So who knows more of about these caravans and all the trouble a refugee could live in? But what I'm saying, so how we can, what is the two questions, like why still we are not succeed to find a structure, preventive measures to for immigration and refugee situation? And when, I mean, I don't like the when people are getting refugees, so this is not something that I love. You know, it is the worst thing a person could experience, to go from one country in another country as a refugee, not as a tourist. So there is two different things. Mm. So the resources versus refugee situation is a question for me.
Mm-hmm. So maybe I'll say a few things. I mean, obviously, you know as much about this, if not more than most of us, but maybe other folks can chime in. I think the first thing is that when we talk about development in the current world, it's really, people have said development looks like more roads, more air conditioners, bigger televisions, bigger malls, and it's a very specific understanding of what development looks like, and that the only real economic structure that we have today is where 8 people have more money than 50% of the planet. And so what's happening is that resources and profits are actually being sucked up. And the logic is, and they say, look, if we make money, it trickles down, right? So they say, look, if we start these mines, we start these corporations, then the whole of society will be uplifted. But in fact, the opposite is happening. It's not a trickle down, but it's a trickle, not a trickle, but like a sucking up economy. What that means is we have to reject at the very basis the idea that to make people better off, foreigners have to go there and build corporations that will either extract goods or create jobs, etc. Because it's not that the industry is being transferred over to the people or profit is being transferred over to the people. It's resources being taken away. It's sweatshops being constructed, as we see in Honduras, but as we see around the world. And in fact, that when governments try to pass laws, like President Zelaya did in 2008, 2009, to force corporations, foreigners, to actually be a little more focused on development of the people, that there will be a military-backed coup that will be backed by countries like Canada to not allow those laws to proceed. So when people say, look, this is just about the way we have to just make jobs, you know, it's this notion. So we have to reject it out of hand. The other thing, and I think, again, you spoke to this very eloquently, is what is a refugee? So, you know, you talk about people are escaping persecution, but they're also wanting jobs. And what has happened in the world with the United Nations, what Trump is saying is, you know, he says they're not real refugees. They're just here looking for a better economic life. It's just about jobs. And so we have this separation of real and unreal so-called refugees. And this division has been, and you can even hear it in Canada, where we'll say, okay, the refugees that were flown in by the government from other countries are real refugees, but people who are crossing the border from the United States and applying inside the country are not real refugees. And then migrant workers who are coming here are choosing to come here and work as they're are not the same as refugees. So we're divided into inland refugees, overseas refugees, migrant workers, international students, undocumented people, asylum claimants, right? So all of these different categories that have been created by the government also have actual regulatory and policy rights attached to it. If you're one of these categories, then you can work for 20 hours. If you're another, you can work unlimited, but only for the employer on your permit, etc. This one, you can get social assistance. That one, you cannot. This one, you get housing. That one, you get EI. So there's actually really material differences between people's access to rights based on the category they're pushed in. But as we all know, people don't have singular lives. People are both leaving war and persecution, and they want good jobs, right? And they want to study, and they want to work. So it's not that they're either students or refugees or workers, etc. So we have to really assert our common humanity as migrants, refugees, racialized, low-wage, working-class people, that there is a shared experience. Of course, there's specificity. It matters if you're from Syria versus Somalia or versus, Honduras. That matters. But it has to be, but there's also a shared commonality, and we can't just be separated on the basis of these categories. And I think as educators and as people who are talking in your community, as people who seem to be working in different industries, where you actually have to make that decision. I know someone said they're from Unison, so your funding says who can you serve, who can you not serve, right? I know someone said they are from a university, so your funding determines which of those people can study and which of those cannot. So certain can and certain cannot. So it trickles down into our entire society, and we have been structured to think in this way. And I think we have to fundamentally reshape the question, both of development and so-called essentially capitalism, as well as what it means to be here and what are these categories and what do they mean to us. Those are just my thoughts. I don't know if somebody wants to jump in on that thread that was just started.
Well, this is Laura from the university, and certainly the whole international student, particularly with postgrad certificates, discourse that's happening, and you know that this is part of business models, and then really that the exploitation of the students that is happening related to this is, you know, is hugely problematic for a lot of people who find themselves in universities, but at the same time, the university is so governed by neoliberal models at this point that it's hugely problematic in terms of making sure resources are here versus completely trying to outright stop these processes from happening. And then, you know, that's another form of barrier then in terms of getting people to the places that they're choosing to go. So it's like, is it a good thing? Is it a negative thing? It's so complex. And there's so many parts to it when you look at just that one particular demographic even.
I'm really curious about this immediacy of people in Tijuana, 5,000 to 6,000 people at the border, and a military blockade, I just really feel like sending lots of like love and peace because I'm aware of how much violence and suffering can happen, and I'm curious if you know anything about that, strategies that are being thought of for people on the ground there. I know there was a solidarity caravan that also arrived, and can you share anything about that?
Absolutely. So I think there are a few key things people can do. So first is to pressure the Canadian government, in particular to reel in the mining companies. You know, you're saying, what about the people who are at the border? But people are leaving these places every day because of the conditions. So we have to force the Canadian government to not support the right-wing government in Guatemala and Honduras and in Honduras, and to stop its mining interest from continuing human rights abuses that are displacing people every day. So that's the first thing. The second is that there is to pressure the Canadian government to issue travel documents. A lot of these people are issuing travel documents in the embassies and consul generals in Tijuana to actually issue travel documents so that those people can actually go somewhere else. Maybe they want to come to Canada, maybe somewhere else, but actually make available the option to apply for refugee status in Canada to the migrants there. So the International Migrants Alliance had a meeting in Mexico, and the Canadian organizations actually issued that as a statement. So I would suggest, so that's something that people can take up. Also, that, you know, we need to focus on, there are many kind of like humanitarian responses. There's fundraising if people want to redirect money. There's a number of outlets that people can go and donate money to. And finally, to ask Canada to change its own refugee laws. So, for example, starting with an end to the Safe Third Country Agreement, to remove the designated country of origin list, which limits people's ability to apply for refugee status, to end detentions and deportations. So, in each of these, maybe it was Paula, I'm not sure, somebody said it was very complicated. I think it is complicated, but there's also very specific organizations of refugees and migrants themselves who are self-organizing, not service providers, not advocates, but self-organizing who are making very distinct calls. So I would really propose and support people in echoing those calls and actually taking direction from those organizations. And we're building a national network that will be launched on Tuesday that will bring together all of those organizations across Canada so that we can amplify and coordinate our voices better. So those are the top calls that are coming. So Safe Third Country Agreement, change the designated country of origin list, push Canada to end its mining abuses and support for right-wing governments in Latin America broadly, and to push Canada to issue travel documents and process refugees in Tijuana and get them papers.
Mm-hmm. Hi, it's Malada. Thank you, Hassan and Rihanna, for organizing this. It's really important, and I'm really happy. One of my questions was, what can we do? But I think you laid out the actions. And could you send us in writing? But because it's really hard to follow up. You know, some of the things I try to write down. But it's really good to have that action items and to do something about it. Speaking on that, I really want to highlight what you said. The irony that the North, it's not only US, even our government, Canadian government, when you look at it, it's us who are creating the problem. Mm-hmm. That's why there's a pushing factor why people are leaving their homeland. It's not easy. It's not a choice. And at the same time, we are not there to create the solution. The irony is, you know, when you talk to people, they think, you know, people who are immigrant, people who are migrants are creating a problem in the society rather than seeing them as an asset. But, you know, when you look at this one, it's not a choice what people are really making. And at the same time, and when you look at it, sometimes it feels like there is indirect colonialism. That's what I would say, because way back, the Europeans went to Africa, to different countries, and colonized and took resources. Now it's a different way of in the name of development, in the name of economic advancement, all this situation are created by the North. That's how it feels. And but I'm really happy that when you say that it's about action, we have to make our government accountable to these issues, because we are not talking about it. You know, when we hear about Honduras, people are talking about US, about Trump. It's not only Trump. There's a structure. and we have to talk about the structure. And at the same time, thank you about those two issues regarding global impact on migration you shared us about the structure. The first one is how people are moving in. And the second one is ensuring the rights and dignity of migrants. It's really important things. I really echo those kind of things. We have to talk about it and we have to advocate. You know, originally I'm from Ethiopia. I know what it means to be to leave your homeland, not by choice, but by force. And thank you.
Absolutely. And I totally agree with you. I mean, this is, you know, colonialism was also marked as about being about economic advancement. It's about civilization of our people, racialized people, poor people from the South. We were going to be made better by the invaders. And always the invaders had some local people who supported them. And always there were some people in resistance and rebellion. And that has not changed, you know. So I think we, you know, there's nothing from, because the economic system there, as is now, is about capitalism, which is specifically about forcing people to work, extracting profit from their work, making money. Basically, people work and the money they make, a large percentage of that ends up being used by just a few people who suck it all up. And that's the system we're in. And I think we've got to like name it and claim it and fight it. And absolutely, I think we need to force the Canadian government to make changes. And I think we need to figure out where we work and live, what are the specific ways in which this thing that we're talking about is impacting us. So, you know, I mentioned a few things about how many of us actually effectively work as border guards, which is to say we deny people rights and services on the basis of their status, different forms of status, right? And we've all been sort of like included into the immigration system. So if you're a doctor, if you're a nurse, if you're a teacher, maybe you're not making the decision who comes into the system, but at the door of the place is somebody who's saying, oh, you don't have papers, you can't come in. And Canada is really segregated in that way. And so we never actually see people. And so there's the work of pushing the government, and I'm saying that has to be done under the leadership of self-organized refugees and migrants. So it's not about one person saying as a refugee or as a migrant, but people who coming together, broad groups of people, and collectively making decisions. And then secondly, we have to figure out what are the specific ways in which we or our organizations are furthering disenfranchisement. And what can we do at that local level to change it? And then thirdly, and this is what I would say, is, you know, as a network of educators and thinkers, we desperately need materials that, you know, people make myth-busting, etc. But we need materials that assert our common humanity as low-wage, so not super rich, right? Racialized migrants from all of these different streams, and to sort of do away with the segregation and separation that all of the different laws and policies are making.
Is there anything else that you could add to what you've already said around Canada's role and how they're like responding to this crisis and the difference between, I guess, sort of the perception of what Canada does and is and what the reality is? Is there any other information you have on that?
I think by and large, the Canadian government has not really spoken about the Honduran crisis. And when it has said nothing about its own role in their displacement. But as a general rule, the government is sort of, in the process, for example, the Global Compact on Migration that was signed last weekend between 160 plus countries, or maybe 130 plus countries, I don't know the exact number. Canada was sort of positioning itself as the global leader of immigration, pro-immigrant and pro-refugee. And this is a myth that people have really bought. I mean, when I immigrated to Canada, which was very recently, you know, in my home country, it was like, if you want to go somewhere that to be treated well, easy to get into, Canada's the place. Like, if we're here, someone told us that that was the truth. And then we learned that that's not so. So, and Canadians believe it. So Canadians believe it, people around the world believe it, etc. So, you know, there are different ways of how to respond. Some people say, look, the correct response is to shed light and show that it's actually a lie. Other people say that we should make Canada keep its word. If it positions itself as the global leader, then force it to become the global leader, accept the myth and make it a reality. I think it's really just about who you're making the argument to. But sort of very factually speaking, Canada has a system, two major things that it does, they're very, you know, very successfully. So the first one is something called interdiction. So interdiction is the process by which you ensure that refugees, humanitarian populations, migrants who will try to get access to your country don't actually arrive at your borders, right? So what that means is that Canada pays countries overseas to block ships from getting here. Canada fines airlines for every person who comes here on a fake document, which makes the airlines responsible for the documentation on sort of the sending country end. When refugees were coming here from Honduras, Canada went across, Hungary. They put up signs in Hungarian and Roma telling people to not come here. When the people started crossing over from the border from the United States, Canada did this huge community engagement process, going to speak to Somalis and Nigerians and Haitians inside the U.S. saying, don't come, you won't get status. So really what the government does really well is that it just stops migrants and refugees from actually getting here through this huge PR, military funding agreements, which means that people in Canada don't really get to see those people because they're stopped well in advance. So the 42,000 people or so that have come crossing the U.S. border is actually a small percentage of people who would actually want to come here if they could. And what that does is it makes us feel like things are better because we don't see this wave because it's happening elsewhere. Okay. The second thing is Canada has an extremely managed migration process, which is the point system, the express entry system, which really ensures that it is people who are much younger who can come here. Younger, richer, fluent in English and or French, and who will live here for many years before they can get their citizenship. So what that does to someone's mentality, so if you come in as an international student, you come in as a temporary foreign worker, but in a high-wage stream, or you come in as a PR, you have to work jobs, it takes you 4 years, you apply for citizenship, or if you come as a student, like 8 to 9 years, you have to do all of these things, you pay so much money, and eventually you quote-unquote earn your ability to get citizenship here. So what that does to your psyche over time is that you start feeling grateful and you start feeling that you earned your way. So you are special. You are better than other people. And you are more advanced in some way because you've been selected. You know, there's lotteries. You get an invitation to apply. Every step along the way, you're made to feel like you passed the test. You are meritocratically selected on the basis of who you are rather than the fact that you were basically selected or who they could extract the maximum profit on. And so it's creating waves and waves of immigrants who are taught to be grateful, to be protectionist, to be exclusionary in and by themselves in their psyche. So those two mechanisms, the interdiction and this sort of like point system, managed migration, get them in young, make them work a lot for it, etc., makes it very difficult to actually deal with the truth of the matter, which is that this is a country that is globally responsible for the displacement of bodies and here is exploiting and excluding people. So we have to contend with those in our work, all of us do. And I think the way to do it is through mass popular education that you're all engaged in.
If you're not a refugee, it's a refugee. They have to struggle, they have to do survival life and so on. They are not a luxury life. But when I say don't come, stay to the country, this is not, or force the government to don't follow these people who are here, to that taking your resources. I mean, it is a big, big, big request. And people who are not listening to us, you know, why you are there? Come back. If things are wrong from a diaspora, a voice, even if I push my Canadian government that don't do this, they said, okay, go back to your country. You are a refugee. I'm a bit confused how to, this is a big cause, this is a nice cause, I agree with you, this is the realities. But what is the strategic intervention to this is a bit of more complex.
What I'd say is, first of all, we say we are here because you are there, which is to say that you are here because they are there, right? So it's not like, oh, if you're a refugee, you don't like it, go back where you came from. It's like, I've been made a refugee because of you. So it is my right to be here. It's not that Canada did this like charitable thing and then let you in. So you have the right to stay here and to criticize. And you have the, you want to live in the world, like if you wanted to move back to Afghanistan and live there, you know, so we talk about freedom to move, freedom to return, and freedom to stay. So to, you didn't move freely because you were forced. Now you're not being allowed to live freely because you can live here, but don't complain, right? This is what I was talking about, the psychic affect of migration. And you don't have the ability to return, even if you wanted to, because things are not safe or not in a way that you wanted. So it's definitely possible to change all of these things at the same time, right? Alone, it's hard. You know, alone, it's like, if I speak, what will people say? If I talk to your, if you talk to your family or your friends, they may not, or your colleagues, they might not agree with you. But there are organizations of thousands of refugees and migrants in Canada that you could join, and you could be part of this one big voice who will have your back and you can have theirs. So in the end, one person can't change the world, but a few people certainly can. And I think that you, each of you have the power, but we have to form organizations. We have to find people first who agree with us, not people who disagree with us, to try and change them. First, the people who agree with us so we can consolidate ourselves. And then we can speak to people who agree with us more or less, and then less, and then we move slowly. If we start with our poll trying to convince people who don't agree with us at all, fighting alone that big wave of what is the dominant opinion, then we'll be thrashed and torn apart. That's, you know, we need to convince our, like, consolidate, get closer, get tighter with our own people. And the segregation and the division and the individualism that's been taught to us is just take care of yourself because you have to, it's hard, you gotta like pay your bills. So we're all separated into our individual boxes, which stops us from coming together and realizing that we have common analysis, common purpose, common goal, common strategy. And it exists, and it's, you can find it in your community quite easily. Not quite easily, but you can find it. And then it'll take effort to join it. And I would really encourage people to form political organizations and groupings because it's so hard. We just end up having these conversations on the side in meetings, but we have to not just come together, but to take action, whatever the action, big or small, but political action that tries to push the envelope every time. And then link up with other people who share it, and then push it further, and link up with other people who share it, so that we can increase our capacity, escalate our response, and collaborate at a national, international, global level as displaced, racialized people with the goal of creating a new world. That's the task we have.
Thank you for joining us on Writing Relations Radio. To find out more, please visit writingrelations.org.